have the pleasure of introducing Dennis Klocek, and I also have the privilege of doing his course this year, which is called Consciousness Studies in 7 months at the Rudolf Steiner College. And when we started organizing this conference, I had just started it. I don't think we even had the name Beyond Polarities yet, but I said, and we all agreed, that we need to get Dennis Klocek. And the more I think about it, Beyond Polarities is a very fitting title for what Dennis is capable of bringing. I had the experience after being in school with him for 7 months, sort of feeling like, man, what have all these other years of school been for? You know, I had the feeling that I was had this satchel that, you know, teachers and professors were throwing rocks in, but there's a big hole in the bottom of all these sort of abstract things that didn't really have anything to do with my life. So those are the two big poles that I feel Dennis really brings together, which is how you live your life and how what you understand affects how you live your life. And then you don't so much have the problem of the satchel, but the problem of not having a satchel and just having to sort of go through things. So Dennis is a lecturer, he's an artist, he's a scientist, he's from New Jersey. New Jersey represent. And yeah, I guess that's all I have to say. Welcome to this.
I'd like to begin just by thanking the organizers for inviting me to do this, to address young people en masse like this. It's a privilege. So I just really want you people who are organizing this to really accept my gratitude for inviting me here. What I see my role in this as is a kind of gadfly, just to put up a few balloons and let them float around. And if you want to look at what's on the balloons, you look at it. And if you think they're just full of hot air, then you can let them float by. Because people of my generation have had, at least my experience in talking with my friends, we've had to learn that there's somehow been a major shift in consciousness, even while we all thought there wasn't. Mm-hmm. Something's happened. And what has happened, we don't really quite know, but the political, economic, the social realm is definitely not what it used to be. And there are many challenges that have surfaced within the last 20 years that point to tremendous opportunities for moving ahead and learning. So the theme that the group chose is Beyond Polarities. When we first started working with it, there was some kind of murky, obscure energies around it, whether or not there is such a thing as beyond polarity. That polarity actually dominates our whole life, and it's basically it's impossible to get beyond it. And in the natural realm, that's absolutely true. So in the context of what happens in nature, polarities dominate and are kind of like the engine whereby natural law unfolds. But Goethe, the great poet, had three levels of polarities that he recognized. The first level of polarity was the polarity of opposites. And then the polarity of opposites, the two polarities reject each other and go in totally opposite directions. And a lot that is surfacing in the social realm has the flavor of those polarities. Basically, it's an I win, you lose not just you lose, but you lose bad. It's just not you lose. You have to be denigrated, humiliated, obliterated, and out of the picture totally, or I'm not satisfied. And that's the polarity of the lowest level. That's a polarity of red in fang and claw of nature. That's survival. I kill you or you kill me. And those are polarities. So the natural law, whereby organisms have to eat each other and prey on each other, that's a level that they're functioning at. But that's not all there is in nature. There's also cooperation. And that's the second level of polarity, with Goethe, what he called the polarity of complements. So in nature, there is red in fang and claw, polarity of opposites. But there's also cooperation and synergy and symbiosis. And that is a higher level of polarity, still polarity, because you still have two poles, but the poles complement and complete each other. And at a higher level in the natural world, that is the social organization of bees, that's the relationship of insects to flowers, of prey to predator. It's actually a kind of beneficial energy between prey and predator at that level, a great, what we could call a great wisdom. And yet, it's still polarity. And the natural law is that it's impossible to get beyond that polarity. But in Goethe's view, there was a third level of polarity, and that's where I would like to really direct my comments, because the third level of polarity is what Goethe called polarity with reciprocation. Not just complements completing each other, but reciprocation means the opposites get so extreme that they flip into the opposite of the opposite. And this is a well-known, in catharsis, in psychology, it's a well-known principle. This is a 12 steps. You have to be in the bottom of the barrel to realize you have a problem. So it's not until you realize that you're powerless and you are deeply problematic that you become soft enough, you become tender enough, become open enough, be willing to become the opposite. To be willing to become the thing that you said you would never be. And that's a great miraculous quality of the third polarity. And that lives very much in the human realm, the potential for that. So reciprocation means that you inspire me to make myself better, something like that. And that is the level of polarity that goes beyond polarities, because the opposites include the opposite. And if I go so far in one direction that I completely polarize and I go to the very bottom of the barrel, I can accept then the possibility of becoming exactly opposite the thing I thought I could never become. And that is an inherently human trait. And it has to do with moral judgment, which is the comments I'd like to make in these keynote talks for the next couple of days is really about moral judgment. Because the whole question of polarities keys on the idea that the human is more than simply just an animal or a machine. The human being carries the potential to become tremendous, to become beneficent, to become forgiving, to become understanding of others, to actually be willing to become others. This is not found in realms outside of humanity. So those are that's kind of the broadest terms that I can place what I would like to bring in front of you, is that the human condition is eminently solvable. is has tremendous potential for becoming new again. And I thought I would just say these because this is a youth conference. And people like myself, I mean, I'm looking certain very strange events right in the eye. You know, like not being on the planet anymore is becoming ever more a reality for me as I wake up in the morning and look at that and go, wow, where'd you get all those lines on your face, man? who are you in there? Looking back at me. So, the young people have great potential. I think what I would like to do is to share with you is how can you best direct that potential so that you can be able to affect the world around you with more ease and with more expertise. That's really what I hope to just bring some pictures for you. So in order to do that, I would like to use this sheet here. This is, I have a certain kind of scheme that I'm going to do every day based on some indications from Martin Luther King about spiritual activism. At the end of his life, he was very keenly aware that there is a difference between activism that has a goal, that expects the change to happen now, and activism that understands that change needs to happen in a spiritual context. And since the time frame of the spirit is infinite, humans have a lot to learn about expectations from activism. So I applaud activism, especially in young people, but there's another dimension to it. And so the four qualities that Martin Luther King brought, the four qualities of a spiritual activist. First one is get the facts and get them straight as you can. Without the facts, if you go off screaming into the wilderness with what you think needs to change, you may find, if you get the facts, that it already has changed. It's just that you were too busy expecting it to change to see that it's changed. So getting the facts and getting them straight as you can, getting them from different sources and getting your ducks in a row, Martin Luther King felt that was the most fundamental task of the spiritual activist. And the second was that once you get the facts don't really answer anything. Because you will have a bag of facts that you bring to the table, but the other person brings a bag of exactly the opposite facts and places them on the same table. And if you're an older person, you know all about that one. So the more you think you've covered, it is the more you learn you haven't. So the second principle is, now that you have the facts, you have to hold the facts simply as facts and understand that the negotiation is where the real energy is. That the facts only answer something from one particular point of view. But as soon as you encounter another human, you encounter another universe. The other human is a completely different species, living on a whole other planet, has a whole other set of gods and goddesses. And basically, the universe is in the center of their armpit, and you better recognize that. So we all know that. And so, then, what Martin Luther King felt was that the facts don't answer anything. They just make it so that you don't get embarrassed. Which is nice when you're trying to prove something with a fact, but it's not correct. Okay? So, I get the facts, then I negotiate, and I may find that when I negotiate, this other universe is not in any way, shape, or form going to accept anything I say. I may find I may have married that other universe on that issue. And therefore, I have a problem. And so what Martin Luther King felt was that if I get the facts, I negotiate, and I realize through negotiation that there's no way for me to get what I want, then the next task of a spiritual activist is to purify. And what he meant by that was, I have to search in myself for the motives of why I expect to win. Why I think that my way or the highway is the best way. I have to purify to look in my own self to see my own motives. And this means usually I have to accept something of the other person's argument. Even if it's only the fact that I can allow them to have an argument in my universe, that goes a long way towards solving the issue. And then finally, once I purify and I can see what my motives are, then I have to act, but I have to act without violence, including verbal violence. That means finding the right language to state my position as clearly as I can without demeaning the other person. These are his four touchstones for political and social activism that goes beyond just my own agenda. Now, the reason I bring these is because these four steps, the consciousness study people know, get the facts is earth, negotiate is water, process, purify, go to a reversal is air, and finally act without violence, will force is fire. So these principles that he brought are probably the deepest social alchemy that we have available. So I'll keep returning to this as a model again and again as I go over different subjects here of hate and fear and doubt and anger and the will to power and things like that that create difficulties when I try to act socially. And I try to change the world, I run into my own self, usually, and my own beliefs is the first thing I run into. And so I just wanted to bring this at the beginning to say this is the theme that I'm kind of thinking of through the whole thing. Now, these four will kind of shape the way I'd like to do the morning keynotes. So to begin with, in getting the facts, I don't judge that I probably have the facts. I probably have my own facts, and probably there's at least 30% of you that think those facts are, should be otherwise. So I would like to bring facts from other people through quotes that I think are related to this idea and use them as what are known as talking points. So I'd like to begin my presentations with like a little mantra or a verse, but this verse could be from Carl Jung or from Thich Nhat Hanh or from Al Gore, to try to say that there are other people who have thought about these things in this way and see if in the discussions that happen later some of these flavors or ideas can circulate. This does not mean in any way, shape, or form that you have to use the talking points in a formal way. Just offer them as an idea, balloons, like I said, to float around to see if we can have some things happen out of our work with each other. So the talking point or the thought that I would like to use for this kickoff comes from the work of Carl Jung. And Carl Jung was an alchemist and an amazing social artist in his own way to perceive the laws of the way in which morality works in the soul. And he focused on this problem of what could be called the great marriage. So the two polarities that I'm going to hang up here as talking points, one is the alarming rise of fundamentalism in today's world. Rapid, widespread, virulent, violent, stupid, fundamental. That stupid is my own word. It's a value judgment. But the reason I say stupid is because this fundamentalism has been there since the very beginning. And the wars are being fought over stuff that happened in 1200 between two people. And people are being murdered every day, hundreds of them, all over the world, because so-and-so did something to so-and-so that we can't even remember. Unless we want to remember it, so that I can have a license to do nasty things to you. Fundamentalism, the one Paul. And basically, fundamentalism is, we're all in the club except you, and you either get in the club or you die. And we could call that the our club syndrome. And in the language of alchemy, that's called the queen. It's a part of the soul that wants everybody to be part of everybody else. And, you know, if mama ain't happy, nobody happy. If the queen is not happy, if we're all not in the club, and we're all not eating the pasta, so if they're not eating your pasta, I see. You can call that queen energy. Every soul has a queen. Every soul. And the queen wants everybody to be on the same page. In the club, eating the pasta, picking up after themselves. You know, we're all in the club. Queen. And the opposite pole to fundamentalism is the will to power, meaning my will to my power. My will is the one that is going to hold sway. I don't care what the whole world says. This is the way it's going to be. Because I see it. And that's the other side, sort of a mono-fundamentalism. It's true forever because I believe it. I. And that could be called king. An object is to get the king and the queen to marry each other so that a baby can be born. And the baby is who you thought you could be before you were born. That's the baby that they need to give birth to. And that's the reason why you came back here, to find out where that baby is under a cabbage somewhere out in the garden. Find that baby, the king and queen get married, and bring the baby to term, and let it live. That's, from the esoteric point of view, that's the goal of life. That's the goal of what we could call self-transformation. So here's Carl Jung, great alchemist and social alchemist, on the problem of getting the queen and the king to get married, on self-transformation. In the processes of self-transformation, the worker, student, the worker, the person is thrown back on him or herself and freed of all illusion. When you undertake to change yourself, you start to see the parts of you that are very unwilling to change. And that frees you from the illusion of thinking that you're changing. And this is a very important thing to be free of, because without it, all you're doing is playing the same tape again, you know, in a gotta da vida, baby, you know. Again and again and again and again. You play it when you're going in the coffin, they put you in all. In a gotta da vida. So put you in your bell bottoms and put you to rest. So if you don't realize you're changing, you're not changing, you think you're changing. When you start to undertake self-transformation, the first thing you realize is, oh my God, I can't change at all. It's a scary thought. But what it does is it frees you from illusion. So in the process of self-transformation, the worker is thrown back on him or herself and freed of illusion. Goals in the reasonable world are a career, a marriage, children, hobbies, fame, etc. However, some people who are ridden by the devil realize that they are still hungry because reasonable things no longer satisfy them. So this is a big deal when you're maturing. You think, you know, I'll make my first million or I finally get my BMW or whatever. And then it's, well, you know, BMW is okay, but a Ferrari would be better. So when you finally realize that even though you're getting stuff from the world, but you're still hungry, and something is still gnawing down in there, that's the beginning of the work of getting the king and queen to speak to each other. That's the what we call the first step on the path. So when we realize that we're still hungry because reasonable things do not satisfy us, if we did get satisfied by reasonable things like career, marriage, children, if they did bring total satisfaction, there would be no philosophy, no religion, no sort of progress whatsoever. That's a pretty radical thing. But there it is. To these persons who are in the process of self-transformation, there is something which always pushes them beyond all existing reasonableness. So I wanted to bring that as a kind of little leitmotif of a thought that self-transformation pushes us into being a bit unreasonable, especially with ourselves, of expecting more from ourselves than we thought we could possibly do. Usually that means accepting ourselves for our foibles without rejecting them, because there's a hidden problem in all of this. And we call that hidden problem the problem of the mirror. It's a mirror, because at a certain point when we're a fundamentalist or we have a will to personal power, we run into the question of, is the thing in the mirror real, or is the thing that's not in the mirror real? And the thing that's in the mirror is what we could call image. So there's a war being fought today for human consciousness over this issue of image. Our whole social realm, political realm, advertising, economics is driven by image rather than being. We care much more about the images of political people than about their actual message or substance. They can obfuscate, prevaricate, oscillate, do whatever, or just stay on message until you wonder where their head is, and nobody ever questions the being. But just how many points on the image scale are being swayed by this? This is a very serious challenge to young people, I feel, as I know that. It's even a challenge to old people, but we've bought a certain package about imagery. It's called being a dinosaur on a computer. So, you know, there's a part of imagery that's like, well, whatever, you know. But young people, image. And a there's a whole realm of image t-shirts. I mean, my kids wore certain t-shirts and did things to their hair that, my God, I would have died if I hadn't that kind of hair and walked into school. That would be the end of my world if I had my hair sticking straight up like this and a little thing on the side and a big earring like that. If I walked into my high school doing that, that would be the end of my life as I knew it. But to my son, it was image. It was, I can be as weird as I want to be. I can project whatever image I want because it's not my real being. And if you judge me on my image, then that just shows me how bogus you are because you don't recognize my real being. So there's this funny little realm in here about image. We're inundated by image, but how many images can you trust? It's a difficult task to be able to decipher the image from the being, because images are being put in such a context that they are designed specifically to prevent you from penetrating to the being that's behind it. They are specifically designed to do that. My middle son is an animator for Pixar. We have very interesting conversations about imagery and stories. He's a Waldorf kid, never had a television in the house. Didn't get on a computer until he was 18 or so. He's now like Photoshop demon on the world. But he still has in him this kind of rudder or a barometer about what is an image that has behind it, is something that moves in a lawful and real way, and what is an image that is just meant to sell me something or just to make some turbulence so I don't pay attention to who I am. It's just a look over here, look over here, look over here, flickering stuff, you know, viral blogging and stuff like that. It's like, how many images can we put together to make you think that this is something that you should be spending a hell of a lot of time watching? Or not. Or who cares? Or does it matter? See, that's where it goes. It's like, who can tell if this image has being behind it or not? I can't. It's CG. It's been designed so that I can't in any way tell how it was made, how in God's name did they figure this out. And so I give up trying to figure it out or penetrate it or make sense of the image. I simply allow the image to come into my organism with a zillion billion other images indiscriminately. And this is a door to being a compartment is made in my soul that separates the king and the queen and says, on one side, you need to be a fundamentalist, my rock group, my, you know, I'm Irish music, no, I'm, you know, Christian rock, no, I'm whatever. Now, world music. Yeah, so now world music used to be, you can't say what this music is. Reggae, ska, you know, Israeli, Hebrew, whatever. And that's our style. That's an attempt at the ego to say there's a being here who can synthesize all this stuff and make some really cool thing you've never heard before. And now world music as a category, it's an image. You see, that's the problem. I worked to make an image. Andy Warhol said it best. There's my 15 minutes of image. And then there's little wheels on it, and it gets moved a little wheel to the side, and then there's the new image. Paris Hilton? Whatever. Paris Hilton 3 years ago, I was like, oh, what's happening? You know, more hits on her website than any other website in the world. in that realm of image, we have this whole question of whose will is behind the making of the image, and what is the motive in that will? Why is this image present? Where is the being behind it? Where is the consciousness behind it? And can I separate for myself a certain time of day where I take an image instead of just allowing it to just keep changing and morphing and being the next, you know, sound bite? Can I hold an image and watch it try to change and try to stay in it in order so that it doesn't change? Can I do that? And that is a fundamental practice of this self-transformation. This task, we could say, of transforming myself. Is, can I take an inner picture and hold onto it long enough to watch what I say to myself when the image starts to go away? Right in there is a being we eventually need to learn to shake hands with if we wish to transform ourselves. That's the one he talks about here, the one who says, you know, there's no illusion about this. And in the language we use in the Consciousness Studies program, we call it the witness. So there's a part of us that understands that every image needs to be challenged, needs to be brought forward. Every image that's coming through, we have to say, I have like an inner filter to say, what's the purpose of this? Is this trying to sell me something? Is this trying to make me do something? Is this trying to make me believe something that will cause someone to have power over me? Or how can I make sense out of this? Because hidden behind the image is a great quality called will. So Madison Avenue and all of the media, now Madison Avenue is kind of an old term. It used to be Madison Avenue. Now it's everybody, every.com. It.com means commercial. And every.com is trying to get you to either buy something or look at this and don't look at anything else. That's what the little banners and all that is. Just keep looking at this. Just look over here. This Victoria's Secret now is on the weather page. If you can go and look in the clouds, you look over here a little bit. So if you go over here, well, there is something behind that. The will is to get you to subscribe and go into Victoria's Secret little place there and kind of surf around. Yeah. What is the will behind it? Now, obviously, we can't do this all the time, or we go nuts. But there is an element of this that we can learn to work with. So, as part of the work that I'm going to do with you is the idea of exercise. So, at the end of my presentation each morning, we're going to do a little exercise in the whole group. You'll just be working with a partner. Very simple things, kind of fun things, little games. But the purpose of every game we do is to witness what happens when I win or lose. So, and the way we do that is we have what I like to call the loser's journal. So at the top of it you go, loser! Okay? And you just write that at the top. Now what happens is, when you get put in a situation where images start to move and you have a feeling like you have no more control, there's a little voice that comes in and says, you know, you just lost. That's what all that means. Why, you are like a loser. And then I have to somehow come back and say, oh, yeah, well, you think so. It's the king and the queen having a not happy breakfast. So the loser is like the joker that comes in and says to the king and the queen, hey, king, weren't you coming in at 3 in the morning last night? Wasn't it you? The queen says, oh, 3 in the morning, really? The loser in the middle, that's the joker. And the joker, the trickster, one side's the joker, and the other side is the witness going, this is a reality. And that joker consciousness and the witness have a kind of Janus space to them. Yeah? And we want to learn to look and see which one is speaking to us. Is it speaking the truth that would never lie? Or is it just bringing up, you're a loser? Even if you're a winner, if you really get off on being a winner, then you're a loser. That sounds strange, but it's true. The real goal of this is to be able to say, what kind of feelings do I have when I'm put in a situation where I have to compromise image? I have to deal with, and the greatest image is my image of myself. So when my image of myself, my expectations of who I am, gets compromised, what do I say to myself? What kind of image comes up in me? How can I get a hold of that? So we're going to play a little game, a little exercise. Now, how many do not know the kids' game, Rock, Paper, Scissors? Yeah, great. So the person next to you is now your partner, so get to know them a little bit. If you're tying, you go dun, 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 like that, right? But you don't have to do it that way. So the goal is that, you know, paper covers rock, scissors cover cut paper, rock smashes scissors. Okay? So it's a very simple game. But behind it is, I'm going to kill you. So we want to try to listen to that, what happens, or, oh, you killed me, I'm such a loser. And that, when it happens, it just happens in a fleeting moment. And so as you go along, I want you to, and you play, you know, best out of 3 or something like that. And you can choose, and you can make friends and have fun. But behind the fun is this voice. And the voice is saying, you just lost. What do you think about that loser there? Or, dude, I'm really creaming this guy. Yeah, I've got it. Both of those have to do with an image of a being that lives in here somewhere, in between the king and the queen. And we want to learn how to shake hands with that being, because that being can tell us what is a bogus image and what is an image that has legs on it that can move me further. The real task of self-development is finding images that can help me transform myself. But I have to have contact with that inner voice. Okay? So as you're playing rock, paper, scissors, what I want you to do is to listen inwardly to how it is when you win and how it is when you lose. So we'll play rock, paper, scissors for about 5 minutes so you get a chance for both sides. I'll blow the whistle or, dance around. And then what I'd like you to do is journal sentence or two, the feelings that you had. We're going to just keep journaling as we go through these little exercises, because there's a lot in them. It's very profound what's going on at a very deep level in the soul, playing little simple games like this. Okay? So while you're playing, you can have one part of your consciousness is watching. How is it to lose? How is it to win? And then write a little bit about that when the whistle blows. Everybody clear? Okay, so I forgot the third category is what happens when we do the same thing three times in a row. And we all laugh. We laugh.
Whoa!
Magic. So that's the third category is, wow, magic. Which is really where that self-transformation is. So, please write now a little bit, what's it like to lose, what feelings, what's it feel like to lose, what's it feel like to win, and what's it feel like to have magic? Thank you. In just an hour and something, is to show you a kind of rhythmic way of working that will allow you to use the elements of your life as an experiment in self-transformation. You don't have to pay, you know, $150 a pop all the time. You can actually help yourself in between times. When you go and visit a professional, that's one thing. But you need to do the work in between. So it's possible. And by doing what we just did, we did a little cycle here. And I'll explain to you the cycle, because as we, each time we come back, we'll be running through the cycle. The cycle is a way of getting some energy into your soul so that you can grab the reins of the horse that is running downhill. Going bananas. Because it smells, you know, the food in the food trough down the bottom of the hill. It's necessary to hold the reins on that horse, and that horse is your will. So in order to, you don't want to choke it, but you definitely want the horse to know whose head it is that is guiding it down towards the goal. So the process we just went through, an earth process, I read from you a quote from Carl Jung. It's a kind of grounding process. It's a thought process. And then I gave you some examples of the problem, outlining the problem, especially through pictures and images and things like that. We started to move into negotiate and work process. Negotiate simply means I have a process going on, and part of it I'm not in control of. So always what you find here is there's a fact, Carl Jung's words, fact. But around it are all these other ideas flowing. And whenever I enter into a relationship with another human being for the purpose of trying to get some understanding, there's always a whole other side of things that are out of my control. Basically, they do whatever they want to do. And however they see fit to do it, that's how they do it. And I'm not really in control of it. Unless I want to be a fundamentalist and say, I'll kill you if you do that because you're not going to the right church. Or if I'm a megalomaniac and say, it's my way or the highway. If I want to somehow be in the middle, I have to tolerate the fact of their obscurity or their ineptitude or whatever. I form a judgment of them. I make an image of them rather than seeing them as a being. I kind of project it onto them. So we kind of did that as a projection. And then I have to purify. When you, I ask you to look at how you felt when you lose or win, that is like shining a magnifying glass in on the way in which the barometer of your soul moves in a very fundamental situation. That's why we laugh when we both throw the same thing three times is because nobody wins or loses, so the pressure's off. And it's a lot more fun than magic. So that is, the looking in is purifying. Whenever I look and see, how do I feel about this? That's an act of purification. Because looking at my own motive brings a tremendous force into my soul of will. And it's not designated to change anything out there, but to change the way I look at things. That's tremendous power that we have. Tremendous. And then finally, I have to act without violence. And in this process that I'm trying to share with you, violence is blaming myself for always losing, or the other person not being able to win, or whatever. We can call it projection. That's violence. It's casting the other person down. It's the root of hatred, basically, as we go along and we'll take a look at it. So what we did in a little short thing was go through these four as a kind of practice. And what that does is as you go through something like that, you get the facts, you negotiate, you let go of control, you go through some kind of process, and then you act. What comes from that, there's a kind of heat in that, a heat of will. I do something. You can hear the energy, the buzz. That's will. And as the buzz starts to happen, people expand. Now, out of that comes a product that has already been mentioned several times, and that is do. In alchemy, the highest substance there is do. And the reason why is because the alchemists considered that the dew was a condensate that came from the movements of the planets in front of the stars and fell into the natural world as an impulse for how the growth patterns needed to happen for the next day. The dew went to them like a holy substance of the action of the creative beings who were in the cosmos. They called it do. And so when I get enthusiastic about playing a game with you and I expand and then I go in and start to purify and start to see what messages I'm giving myself, there's a kind of vapor created around me of will. And then I want to collect that dew. The old people used to collect the dew in bottles and actually give it as a medicine. Flower essences today is just that, and homeopathy is that. And so when you worked and had a laugh and were having fun with the person, you expanded. Now out of that, what we want to do is collect that in a vessel. The vessel you collected the dew of that exchange in was the journal. So I saw about 30% of the people journaling. And the other percent of the people were just hanging on, remembering what a cool time they had playing rock, scissors, paper. Unfortunately, when you just remember, it evaporates like the dew in the morning. Unless you journal. If you journal, what you're doing is putting a little doom by, and then again, and then again, and then again. After a while, your witness shows up in the journal and says, this is how I speak to you when you feel this way, and this is how I speak to you when you feel this way. So the process we went through is an alchemical process, trying to loosen the soul a little bit so that it can eventually build an organ that can perceive the difference between an image that's just trying to sell me something or force me to do something I don't understand, and an actual image that I choose within myself that becomes a tool for self-transformation and higher development. Thank you.